Okay, let's just jump right in. We need to start with a moment that honestly should have been a massive wake-up call for every capital in the West.
You're talking about the Kyiv missile strike?
The KN-23 strike in this Fyodoshinsky district this past April. I mean, a major residential area gets hit, civilians are killed, but the detail that matters most for you for our deep dive today is where the debris came from.
Right. That debris field is the physical proof of something the U.S. intelligence community has been warning about for years.
And what's that specifically?
That the cooperation between China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea is no longer theoretical. It's not happening behind closed doors anymore.
It now has, as our sources say, debris fields and death tolls attached to it.
Exactly. It shows a functional military supply chain that stretches halfway across the globe.
And that completely changes the conversation in Washington.
Oh, absolutely.
Suddenly, this isn't four separate foreign policy problems. It's one coordinated strategic threat, an intertwined network.
And that brings up the big question.
How do you fight a network?
And network, yes, when your whole bureaucracy, the State Department, the Pentagon, Treasury, it's all built to handle these things one by one, in silos.
That's the fragmentation problem. And that's our mission for this deep dive, to explore how the U.S. government is attempting this fundamental institutional rewrite to deal with this adversary alignment.
They're trying to match the wiring of the bureaucracy to the shape of the actual threat on the ground.
And the tool they're using, the centerpiece of this whole effort, is a piece of legislation that started out as the Disrupt Act.
The Defending International Security by Restricting Unacceptable Partnerships and Tactics Act. The name really says it all.
It does, but its new identity is probably more important. It got absorbed into Section 1273 of the Fiscal Year 2026 National Defense Authorization Act.
The NDAA. And that was signed into law in December 2025.
So it's law now.
It's law. And Section 1273 is basically Washington's formal acknowledgement that this cooperation is a single strategic problem.
Okay, so to really get why this law was so necessary, we have to look at what's been happening over the past couple of years.
The exact period that drove Congress to act, yes. The alignment has been solidifying across three, I'd say, really crucial domains.
So let's lay those out. What's the first one?
The first is the most obvious one, the battlefield itself.
The KN-23s we mentioned.
That's the poster child for it. But the transfers go a lot deeper. U.S. Defense Intelligence has confirmed Iranian Shahed drones, of course.
The workhorses of the Russian air campaign.
And this is critical, the provision of FAT-360 short-range ballistic missiles to Moscow.
Okay, hold on. Why is the FAT-360 so important? We hear about the drones all the time, but what does that missile transfer really signify?
It signifies a much deeper commitment, a willingness to provide a higher-end capability.
Yeah.
The FAT-360 is a mobile surface-to-surface system. It's a precision strike weapon.
So Iran is directly upgrading Russia's offensive power.
Yes. They're allowing Russia to sustain these high-tempo strikes without burning through their own best weapons. This isn't a rumor anymore. It's a reality that's changing the conflict.
And this battlefield cooperation is being matched in the diplomatic sphere, isn't it? That's domain number two.
It is. Just look at the 20-year Comprehensive Strategic Partnership Treaty that Russia and Iran signed.
That was back in January of 2025.
And that treaty is monumental. It's not just symbolic handshaking. It's a formal commitment to deepen defense, intelligence sharing, and energy cooperation.
But the real kicker for policymakers was something else.
The real headline is that the treaty explicitly aims to mitigate U.S. sanctions pressure. Sanctions evasion is now an institutional, codified part of their relationship.
Which is a direct attack on one of America's primary tools of foreign policy.
It is. And that diplomatic cover leads right into the third domain, the economics of it all, the sanctions evasion.
This is where China comes in.
China is the essential financial plumbing for this whole network. They become the primary buyer, the lifeline, for both Russian and Iranian oil.
They provide the market that keeps these two heavily sanctioned economies going.
Exactly. And while there have been some recent coordinated sanctions on Russian oil companies and Chinese ports, everyone expects workarounds.
Ghost fleets, obscure shell companies, that sort of thing.
The problem is fluid, but until Section 1273, the U.S. response was often rigid.
And this gets us right back to that fragmentation problem, the whole reason for the legislation.
It does. While the adversaries were building a network using Chinese banks to pay for North Korean missiles delivered by Russian trains, Washington was still, largely set up to handle them one by one.
A Russia shop, a China shop, an Iran desk.
And that stovepiping, as they call it, was fatal to a coordinated response. You had analysts at the Russia desk watching the Black Sea and analysts on the Iran desk watching the Persian Gulf.
And no one was mandated to connect the dots when both streams of oil ended up at the same port in China.
Or if they did, the competing regional priorities meant the intelligence often just got missed or wasn't acted on with any real urgency. The system was just not built to see the network.
Which explains the push for a legislative fix. So how did they get this done? Washington is, let's be honest, notoriously difficult to navigate.
The legislative journey here really shows you how serious Congress was. The original Disrupt Act, S-1883, was highly bipartisan when it was introduced in May 2025.
And it spelled out the threats very clearly, didn't it? I think there were four key findings.
That's right. Shared tech, speeding up military modernization, mutual economic lifelines that blunt sanctions, developing non-dollar payment systems.
And the big one, the risk that a crisis with one, say North Korea, could quickly drag in the others because of these deep ties.
That recognition was the key political catalyst. But here's a crucial point about the bill itself, now Section 1273. It is not a sanctions bazooka.
Or a new weapons program.
Not at all. In fact, when the Congressional Budget Office scored it, they found it had basically no direct impact on spending.
Okay, I have to admit, I'm skeptical of that. If it doesn't spend new money, does that just mean overworked analysts get another meeting to go to? The source material describes it as mostly rearranging existing furniture.
And that's a fair point. It is a massive administrative lift. But that's the whole idea. It's a mandate from Congress for the executive branch to get organized.
To reorganize its people and its priorities without needing a huge new budget.
Precisely. The law is using its authority to force cooperation, which is incredibly hard to do in the bureaucracy otherwise.
So how did it become law? The Senate bill cleared committee, but the key move was folding it into the NDAA.
Exactly. They inserted its requirements as a whole new subtitle F in Title 12 of the Senate's defense bill. And the NDAA is what's called must-pass legislation.
It's one of the few bills that Washington absolutely has to pass every year, which makes it a great vehicle for policy changes like this.
And you had the House with its own companion bill, H.R. 5912, which served as a bargaining chip to make sure the core idea stayed in the final version.
Which is how we got Section 1273 of the FY26 NDAA signed in December.
The statutory backing to force that structural rewrite.
Okay, so let's dig into that rewrite. If the old way was episodic, just reacting to events, what does Section 1273 actually mandate that changes how people work day to day?
It requires a strategic pivot from improvisation to a coherent, structured campaign plan.
A plan for the whole government.
A whole government strategy, diplomatic, informational, military, economic. And it has to be periodically updated. They're being forced to stop improvising and start planning ahead.
And it's not just one department writing a report. What's the new bureaucratic machinery that's now mandatory?
The law mandates specific organizational changes. State, defense, treasury, commerce, the DNI, the CIA, they all must establish dedicated task forces.
Not just temporary teams.
No, these are continuous bodies whose only job is to analyze how these four adversaries cooperate and then recommend policy changes.
And the crucial part is they have to talk to each other. They can't just stay in their old silos.
That is the most important structural change. These task forces have to contribute to a joint report.
A single report.
Laying out how the U.S. intends to disrupt, frustrate, and constrain the most dangerous parts of this cooperation over time. It forces a unified analytical framework, no more fragmented regional desks. The government is now legally required to connect the dots.
This is where it gets really interesting. Let's go back to those events from the past couple of years and ask, how would Section 1273 have changed the response?
Okay, let's start with the KN-23 missile strike in CAV. The DPRK-Russia arms transfer.
Under the old system, the response was reactive. Confirm the missile's origin, issue some statements, maybe sanction a few entities after the fact.
Right. But with Section 1273 in place, that dedicated DPRK-Russia task force would already be running.
So what would they be doing differently?
They'd be on the hook, not just to analyze debris, but to continuously map the entire logistics and financial chain months in advance.
The shipping routes, the rail lines in Russia, the financial intermediaries.
All of it. The benefit is you can target the connective tissue of the relationship systematically. Instead of sanctioning one ship after it docks, the goal would be to compromise the entire route before the next missile even leaves port.
That's a huge shift. Okay, scenario two. Diplomacy and crossover risks. the Iran-Russia treaty and those FAT-360 missiles.
Before this act, you'd have the State Department managing the treaty aspect and the Pentagon tracking the missiles.
Yeah.
The strategic connection between the two wasn't a mandatory point of analysis.
But now it is.
Now, that treaty and those missile transfers would automatically trigger structured analysis. The act forces agency to think hard about those crossover risks.
Crossover risks like what? Iranian systems get bad access to Ukraine and then show up in the Middle East, maybe with Russian upgrades?
Precisely that. Or Russian electronic warfare tech, which is very good, yeah, migrating into Iranian systems that then threaten U.S. allies in the Gulf.
So you have to treat it as a single, multi-regional problem.
Supported by pre-planned options, not just fragmented one-off measures.
All right, final scenario. The economic lifelines. China buying up all that Russian and Iranian oil?
Historically, those were two completely separate sanctions programs, one for Russia, one for Iran.
But with Section 1273.
The government is now required to analyze Russian and Iranian oil flows to China and all the financial plumbing that supports it as one intertwined adversary network.
Because it's often the same shell companies and insurance providers servicing both supply chains.
Exactly. So instead of wasting resources running two parallel investigations, you combine the analysis.
And you create a standing cross-agency plan?
A standing plan, yes.
Yeah.
For coordinating sanctions against the key hubs and intermediaries that help both Tehran and Moscow. This prevents the network from just shifting resources from one sanctioned country to another. You treat them as a unified financial target.
That is a profound change. But here comes the reality check. Washington is full of healthy skepticism for any plan that just involves creating a task force and writing a strategy. Mm. There's a real risk this becomes what some staffers call a book report factory. It generates paper, but doesn't actually change policy.
That skepticism is well-founded. We've all seen glossy strategies gather dust on a shelf. The effectiveness of Section 1273 really depends entirely on the follow-through.
Especially since it didn't come with a big new budget.
Right. So two things have to happen for this to work.
What are they?
First, Congress has to treat the reports and strategy updates as the beginning of a conversation, not the end.
They need to use them to drive budget decisions, hold hearings, and make sure these new task forces are staffed with top talent.
And second, the executive branch itself has to actually embrace this. They can't just treat adversary alignment as a new buzzword. They have to use the law as a lever to force hard choices and genuinely shift away from those comfortable old silos.
It's a tool, but only if they pick it up and use it.
If that happens, Section 1273 is, well, it's profoundly important.
Right.
It's the first major structural change that tries to match the wiring of the U.S. government to the actual shape of the threat we've been seeing evolve.
A fundamental change in how Washington will have to operate. So what does this all mean for you? The act defines this problem more clearly than any law before it. It provides a framework that was just missing. So if you think about all the tools the U.S. already has, sanctions, export controls, intelligence assets, and now they all have to be included in one joint coordinated strategy, here's a thought to leave you with. Which specific existing tool do you think will be the most effective against a coordinated adversary network now that it's part of this new unified framework?